Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. What is Aleppo? That was a question asked third-party libertarian candidate Gary Johnson recently, and he got in a lot of trouble for it. He did not know what is Aleppo. Well, today I have a primer, not just for Gary Johnson, but for you, on all facets of the Syrian conflict. It is, dare I say, the worst ongoing horrific spot in the world today, with the possible exception of North Korea, but actually I think Syria is even worse. Worse than Iraq, worse than anywhere around the globe. And we need to know what's going on there and to understand it from various perspectives. But first, we probably should begin with the famous Gary Johnson clip. Let's roll.
Category. What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Aleppo is in Syria. It's the it's the epicenter of the refugee crisis.
Okay, got it.
So Gary Johnson didn't know what Aleppo was. Later on, he said that he thought it was an acronym. But then later on, he was actually very honest that he just really didn't know the name of the city or what was going on there. And he apologized and said he should have known. And I do think he should have known. And when we're finished talking today, I think you'll understand why I think it's so important that we all know what's going on in Aleppo. You may have heard news just today. A new ceasefire has been announced between Russia and the United States that will supposedly take place between the Syrian government run by the dictator Bashar al-Assad, and that is supported by Russia, and the Free Syrian Army supported by the United States. There are also the Kurdish forces supported by the United States. And supposedly, if this lasts a week, they'll all be able to fight together, supposedly against the Front, which is the Islamic group that is an offshoot of Jabhat al-Nusra, which comes from al-Qaeda, as well as ISIS, the one that we've all heard the most about, another Islamic terrorist group, the one that goes out in the West and kills a bunch of civilians. These are not the only players in the conflict. Iran is there, along with Hezbollah, along with Turkey, along with Saudi Arabia. It's quite a large crowd. So to understand what's going on in Syria, and I don't expect you to follow every word I just said unless you really know what's going on. That's a lot more than knowing where Aleppo is. Aleppo, by the way, is Syria's largest city. It'd be like asking, where's New York City for the United States, or where's Berlin for Germany. It is the largest city in Syria. Damascus is the capital. Aleppo is the largest city. It's an ancient city. It's one of the oldest cities on the earth, actually, along with Damascus. That's all part of the Fertile Crescent. You can study it, as I've studied history, and know there are ancient structures there that are as old or older than the ones in Jerusalem. It's that old city, a once very beautiful city. Again, if you think America's old, then you look to Europe and you say, but Europe, there are places that are 1,000 years old. Here are places that are thousands of years old. But I want to talk about the current Syrian crisis, because it's not just Gary Johnson who I think should understand what's going on. It's you and me and everyone in America. I want to talk about why not only we should understand, but why we should care what's going on the other side of the earth. This isn't a show about Gary Johnson, but it should be noted that the libertarian argument is pretty much don't worry about the rest of the world. I think libertarians tend to be isolationists. And no doubt we have had our series of fiascos all over the world the Iraq War being the most recent, Vietnam perhaps being the best example. There are other examples. I also think we've had successes all over the world. World War II, of course, is the classic good example, but I even think that our war in Bosnia, and even, and we may dispute this, our war in Libya has been a success. I want to put all that aside for the moment. I want to talk about Syria. And in thinking about how to approach a very complex topic today, I was reminded of one of my favorite works by one of my favorite authors. The author is William F. Faulkner. William Faulkner, and the book is The Sound and the Fury. Faulkner, one of the greatest American novelists, wrote from a Southern American perspective. But what's unique about Faulkner's writing is not the Southern perspective. It was how he took the structure of writing, how he told stories. Typical book is chronological, right? You begin in the beginning, you continue to the middle, you go on to the end. And maybe there's a flashback or something like that. There's usually what they call the omniscient narrator, the person who speaks in the third person, and he did that, and she did that, and they did that. It may have a protagonist who's mostly focused on the main character, but usually we talk, a narrator talks in the third person. If the book's about Mark Levine, they say Mark did this, Mark did that, Mark thought that. Occasionally you find books, a little rarer, written in what's called the first person. Basic grammar, folks. First person is I, my, myself, speaking about yourself. First person plural, by the way, is we or us. That's you and someone else. The second person, and I've only seen one book in my life written in the second person. It's Bright Lights, Big City. Great book there. It's you. You, your. That's the second person, the person you're talking to. And the third person is he, she, it, sort of the narrative. Well, Faulkner wrote in the first person, meaning he wrote from the perspective of a character in his novel. But he wrote from several first persons. This, by the way, is the first, I think, literary analysis I've done on the Inside Scoop. I like to bring in a range of disciplines when I do my discussions. And the genius of The Sound and the Fury, and it really is one of the great works of literature worldwide, and certainly in America, is that he wrote from several perspectives. Chapter one, and I'm not going to get into the whole book, though you should read it, is told from a person who is mentally disabled. Very interesting to tell a story where the narrative is told by a narrator who doesn't quite understand what's going on, but has the perspective of someone filtered through their own mental disability. A fascinating beginning. And there's a famous short story, Flowers for Algernon, which does a similar thing. But Faulkner goes beyond that. After telling the entire tale, and it dips around chronologically as someone who would be mentally disabled might do, they don't think linearly. After telling the story in part one from this perspective of this person who's mentally impaired, he then tells part two. Part two is from another person's perspective, someone else in the story, someone we've gotten to know about through the first narrative, but told in a different way. And we learn a little more truth. And then he tells part three from yet a third character in the story, and part four from yet a fourth character in the story, from her perspective. And when you think about it, despite this being a very highly unusual technique in literature, what Faulkner did in The Sound and Fury, it's actually much more akin to the truth, right? The journalist style, this happened, this happened, this happened, that's not how we view life. In fact, when that we read things by journalists, we're often suspect because things are not so clear all the time, and then we get into the horrible world of red news and blue news where, you know, Democrats get one source, Republicans get another source. The truth is that we all see the world a little bit differently, through different eyes, through different perspectives, through different filters, through different biases. And given that the Syrian conflict is so incredibly complex, with tons of actors all interacting one to the other, I felt that the best way to describe this story is to give you the perspective from each of the various actors. I'm adjusting the video on Facebook. By the way, if you want to watch this, watch me on Facebook, all you have to do is go to facebook.com/MarkLevineTalk, and the light's bad, but at least you can see me. Hey, Facebook folks. So, with Faulkner as my model, The Sound and the Fury in particular, I want to discuss the Syrian conflict from various perspectives. I'll start with what I consider to be the most sympathetic perspective, the people that I most relate to, the people that would eventually become the Free Syrian Army, the Kurdish forces. These are the ones that I'm most sympathetic to. These are the ones, by the way, that American policymakers are most sympathetic to. But then go on and discuss the other actors. How does Assad, the dictator, see it? How does Russia see it? How does Iran and Hezbollah see it? How does ISIS view the conflict? Why would someone join ISIS in the first place? Who is Jabhat al-Nusra? Sounds like a bad Star Wars character. Why are they involved? What about a civilian that just wants to be left alone? You know what? I'm going to start there. When we cut back from break, I'm going to do the Syrian perspective, and I'm going to start from a Syrian civilian who just wants to be left alone. Gary Johnson, listen up. This is your tutorial. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Today we're discussing Syria, not just because Gary Johnson didn't know where Aleppo was, but because you should. And I want to tell you why you should care. But before we get to why you should care, why the American perspective, as it were, I want you to put yourselves in the shoes of an ordinary person in Syria. So, and I'll do this in the second person. So you live in Syria, you're in the majority of the population, you're a Sunni Muslim, you're not that religious like most Syrians, you might go to mosque every now and then, you really don't pray five times a day like you're supposed to, but you'll go on the holidays, you'll go with your family. You've had, a little bit about it. You've been to mosque before, but it's not very important to you. You're concerned about your job. Your job is a school teacher, and you really care about children, and you're a math teacher. And that's really good that you're a math teacher, because if you were a history teacher, you'd have to do a lot of lying. The dictator, Bashar al-Assad, has been in power now for, more than a decade, ever since his father, Hafez al-Assad, died. And you understand that's just the way things are in Syria. The dictators, stay in power. You vaguely remember that you had a friend in a city 30 years ago called Hama. But you know that city doesn't exist anymore, and that friend is dead, because when Hafez al-Assad was alive, there was a revolt against the dictator, this Assad's father, and it was the fourth largest city in Syria, and Hafez al-Assad decided to raise it to the ground, murder everyone in it. At least 20,000 people were murdered. We will never probably know the exact number. And he took the fourth largest city in the country, your country, and now it's a field. And that was a real sign that revolting against Assad is a very dangerous thing to do. But then came the Arab Spring. Then came a fruit seller in Tunisia who was tired of not being able to sell his fruit. He was tired of government officials going and stealing the fruit from his cart, and there was nothing he could do about it because it was a dictatorship in Tunisia, too, and the government was in control, and that fruit seller just got fed up. He got so fed up with living under the thumb of the dictatorship in Tunisia, so angry, so upset, he couldn't even sell his fruit to take care of his poor mother that, well, he poured gasoline on himself and set himself afire on camera. And as awful as that sounds, that flame spread across the Middle East. There were uprisings in Tunisia that overthrew the government. There were uprisings in Libya that, with America's help and Europe, overthrew Gaddafi. There were uprisings in Egypt that overthrew that country. There were uprisings in Algeria that did not succeed. There were uprisings in Jordan, even a little bit in Saudi Arabia, more in Bahrain, that was put down by the Saudi regime. Some of these succeeded. Some of them did not. But all across the Arab world, and you speak Arabic, that's the language of Syria, all across the Arab world, people were rising to overthrow their dictators. And you know that in the Arab world where you live, where you've lived your entire life, every country is a dictatorship. Every single one. Not a single one lets you vote for their leaders. Not a single one allows free speech. Now, some are more lax than others. The kings of Morocco and Jordan are less harsh than, well, Assad is in Syria, or Gaddafi was in Libya, but you've never known freedom before. So what happens in Tunisia electrifies you. Maybe you could have freedom after all. You didn't start the conflict. It happened in Tunisia. It didn't even happen in your country. And then you hear that in a small town in Syria near the Jordanian border, Daraa, there's an uprising. And the people kicked out the government and declared free Syria. Now, you're very sympathetic to the free Syrian movement. You want to live free. You want to be able to speak out. You want to be able to teach. You know that your fellow teachers are constantly being censored. But you're deathly afraid. You know that Bashar Assad is a dangerous dictator. You know that his father massacred tens of thousands of people. You're really afraid. You are not getting involved in this conflict. You're going to lay your head down. You live in the greatest city in Syria, the richest city, the largest city. You live in Aleppo. And you're going to continue teaching math because you care about kids. And sure, you'd love to be free. But no way are you getting involved in this conflict. And when the people get out and start marching in Aleppo, you stay inside. You're afraid. You got a wife. You got three kids. You need to stay out of this. And your wife is telling you, stay out of this. Because a bunch of your friends are going to march. And they're calling you a coward. They're marching in the street. They're risking their lives to overthrow the dictatorship. You are gonna lay low. And the Free Syrian Army starts to build up. Suddenly, there are thousands and then tens of thousands of Syrians in the streets, in Aleppo, in Damascus, all across the country. It, this little wildfire spread from Tunisia to this small town of Daraa, and now it's growing across Syria. And now you start to think there could be a future beyond Assad, a future where you can actually live your life in freedom without the government, this dictatorship always on your neck. We'll talk about what happens next. I think you probably know. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back after this.
Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. The story of what's going on in Syria from the perspective of the people of Syria. I think if you're going to understand what's going on in the world, you have to get into people's heads. You have to understand their motivations. And at a time when the United States and Russia have just announced the second ceasefire, no one knows if it'll last a few hours, much less a week, when they're finally going to bring humanitarian supplies into Aleppo, Syria's largest city. It's important to understand how we got here. And by we, I mean we humans. Because I think there's a tendency sometimes to think, well, these are people on the other side of the world. They don't matter to us. I understand that. I guess it's part of Donald Trump's America First campaign, and certainly any president of the United States has to always put the needs of the citizens of the United States first. But I don't think it means we ignore the rest of the world. Sometimes when we don't do anything to help a problem in the rest of the world, it does come back to bite us. And sometimes we get involved and things get worse. Indeed, that's the real question in Syria, isn't it? But first, before you try to resolve any problem, particularly one as extremely difficult as this one, first you got to find out what's going on, right? You know, I know people like this. I'm sure you do too. The people who you start to tell them there's a problem and they immediately jump to act. And you're like, wait, you don't know all the facts yet. Certainly, we should know all the facts before we act. Certainly, we wouldn't trust someone to solve a problem in Aleppo if they've never heard of Aleppo. And that's not just for Gary Johnson, that's for Donald Trump as well. I wish someone had asked him the question, what is Aleppo? Better yet, why don't we ask Donald Trump, what is Hezbollah? What is the Free Syrian Army? What is Iran's role in Syria? Why do people join ISIS? I'd love to hear his answers. These are some of the questions that I hope to explain for you today. When we last left our hero, the math teacher in Aleppo, a young man with a wife and three kids, he was excited about, and by the way, this is just my concoction out of my head. I'm not naming a specific math teacher. You get the idea. But when we last left our hero, he was happy about the Syrian revolution, but also nervous, extremely nervous. He knew how brutal the Assad family could be. His friends, many of them went off to join the peaceful revolution. They asked him to join. He said, no, I'm not going to risk it. I have a wife. I have three kids. And his friend said, it's peaceful. It's peaceful. We are marching in the streets of Syria shouting, peaceful, peaceful. We have flowers. We give them to the troops. And you, I guess you're the hero of the story. You're the math teacher. You say, you know what? I fear the future. And indeed, your fears come true. Not only are your friends fired upon, including your really good friend who shouted, peaceful, peaceful, as he was executed in the streets. But Assad decides the only way to stop the revolution is not just to kill the protesters in the streets, but to do what his dad did. Make whole neighborhoods, whole cities, cease to exist. See, it's not enough to kill the fighters. You have to kill their wives. You have to kill their children. You have to make them no more. So Assad starts dropping what are euphemistically called barrel bombs on neighborhoods throughout Syria. Now, a barrel bomb sounds like a bomb the size of a barrel dropped over a neighborhood. It's actually much worse than that. These barrel bombs are the size of, your average Dimsty dumpster, just for an American perspective, full of nails, shrapnel, really, really sharp objects, designed not just to kill as many as possible, but to maim, to bleed, to make sure that the child hiding under the rock gets hit too. The goal, remember, is not just to kill the people fighting Assad, but to terrorize people so they never, ever, ever fight again. Whole neighborhoods are wiped out, including your cousins in Daraa. You never heard from them again. And your city of Aleppo starts to be bombed. Block by block turns to rubble. It's not quite so systematic, though. It's not like they start in the south and then move every block to the north, because then you could see it coming. No, it's a block here, a block there, a block there. You never know when it's going to come. You never know when your life is going to end. Your 4-year-old wets his bed. your 8-year-old gets into screaming fits whenever she hears the bombs. Your 12-year-old, he's tough. He wants to join the Free Syrian Army. You tell him he cannot. He has to go to school. But you're understandably worried. Your brother says, I'm getting out of here. You say, where are you going to go? He says, I don't know. I'm just getting out of here. You say, there's no place to go. The refugee camps are full. Lebanon is in control of Hezbollah, which is an ally of Assad, who's doing the murders. He's going to try to make it to Jordan. Jordan, a country of 2 million people, has 2 million Syrian refugees all living, baking under the heat of a sun in some makeshift camp in the middle of the desert where people are starving. You wish your brother well. You decide to stay. Aleppo is under the control now of the Free Syrian Army. These are good people. These are some of your friends. These are other school teachers. God knows there's no school anymore. These are the local grocer and your doctor, all of whom have stopped what they were doing and are fighting, including some of the women as well. And you're glad they've taken over your city. You hope this will be the beginning of a Syrian revolution, but you're very, very afraid. The bombs keep coming from the air, flattening whole neighborhoods. You think, you know, I've heard the United States cares about people fighting for freedom. Why aren't they helping us? Where are the Europeans? The people who praised the Arab Spring and thought that we would make our freedom, where are they? They're nowhere to be found. You've heard some president in the United States called Obama said there would be some red line about chemical weapons, and a bunch of Syrians in a nearby city were gassed, and neither President Obama nor the other party, the Republicans in Congress, none of them wanted to do anything about it. And you do hear Obama got rid of serious chemical weapons, and I guess that's good, but, you know, a few thousand were killed by the chemicals, and hundreds of thousands are being killed by these barrel bombs every single day. And Aleppo is getting increasingly surrounded. Assad's troops have surrounding the city that's under siege. Food's growing short. There's no milk for the 4-year-old. There's barely enough rice. He's starving before your eyes. The one access road to Turkey has been cut, and you realize that you're all going to die. You've kind of made peace with that. And then you hear that crazy guy that went to your school who was an Islamic nutcase, the guy who hated America, the guy who hated Jews and Christians, the guy who used to, I mean, he would rape women and no one would, I mean, he was a terrible person, he was a criminal. He's joined this group called ISIS. And ISIS is going to help your family not starve. What? These terrible people? Oh, they're not there to help your family. They're there because they want to impose an Islamic caliphate over the entire country, which you think is ridiculous and dangerous. You believe in women's rights. The vast majority of Syrians do. You're a secular person. You're an educated person. These bumbling, ignorant savages, you don't want anything to do with what they want to do, but if they'll break the siege, make sure your children get some food. Bring them on in. It's not like Europe or America's helping any. And there's another Islamic group. It's called Jabhat al-Nusra. It came from al-Qaeda. I think those are the people that took the American trade towers down. You remember feeling really bad for America that day, but You don't really want their help either, but your family is being starved to death, and at this point, you'll take about any help you can get. Your friends in the Free Syrian Army tell you that they don't want them either, but they have no choice. They come in, they actually break the siege. Then Russia decides to get involved, and they drop even more bombs on neighborhoods, purportedly to get al-Nusra, but a lot of it just gives Assad more opportunity to just start murdering more people, which is how this whole thing started. And where's the United States? You hear that there's a Secretary of State somewhere that's trying to help. You've kind of given up hope in him. And you folks end up actually surrounding Assad's troops. Well, not you. You're just trying to live with your family, but the Free Syrian Army does. And, well, now there may be a ceasefire soon. That's the perspective of the most sympathetic character in my mind, the average innocent Syrian person. I'll try to give you a few other perspectives as well. Clearly, that's the one I most relate to. But I also relate to the Kurds. Kurdish people. If you're a Kurd, you're part of a long, proud people. You're not Arab. It's a separate people. You speak a different language. You don't speak Arabic. You speak Kurdish. You're Muslim, but it's a different people. And frankly, you don't much like the Arabs because they've been conquering your territory for centuries, and they won't give you a free state where you can teach the Kurdish language and Kurdish culture in your schools. And you have people, family, cousins in Syria and Turkey and Iraq and Iran, and none of them are allowed to truly be Kurdish and to be free with Kurdish culture. And when the wars start, you just rely on your Kurdish brethren, and you want them to be free, and you want to work with the United States and be free and democratic, and you got no problems with Christians or Jews or anyone. You just want to practice your culture and teach your language to your kids. Is that so hard? What is so wrong with that? Sure, you'd like an independent Kurdistan, but at the moment, you just want to be able to practice your culture, and it's been put down by people, all the dictators of the region, and even Turkey, which is supposed to be a democracy, puts you down. And then the war happens in Syria, the horrors, the barrel bombs, they're after your family too. You join with your Arab neighbors, you try to fight back. Again, you want, and you hear the United States is going to help you, but the help is fleeting. It's minimal. You're basically, though, on the side of the Free Syrian Army. And from the Free Syrian Army's perspective, well, I kind of gave you a little bit of their perspective when I gave you the story that I concocted about the school teacher. They kind of feel the same way, except, well, now they're in charge. And they fought this war. They've got, I mean, you're in the Free Syrian Army. You're a hero. You're someone who's risked your life to fight for revolution, to fight for freedom, and everybody hates you. It's not just that ISIS hates you and al-Nusra hates you because you don't want to establish an Islamic State. Assad is trying to kill you. Hezbollah, which is Iran's terrorist group, is trying to kill you. And Russia, this huge superpower, is out to kill you. And America, the country that you want to reach out to, is talking a lot but doing practically nothing. And now you're in control of territory. Territory you want to establish Free Syria under. But no one is helping you. The few arms you get from Saudi Arabia, they get taken by ISIS. There is no no-fly zone. The barrel bombs keep dropping on villages, murdering your friends and family, and you're just ready to fight to the death, just going to fight to the death. But even the people that you're supposedly taking care of are angry at you. You started this, they tell you. You started this. You dreamed of freedom, you idiot. And now we're all being murdered. And now our kids are dying. This math teacher knocks on your door. This friend of yours, this close friend of yours, and he's crying and he's begging you, surrender. Call it off. Yeah, you're going to be executed, of course, but if you're not executed, we all die. There is no hope for Free Syria. There is no hope for freedom. We are all going to die. My kids are starving. Stop this. So when ISIS knocks on your door and says, we don't agree, but we have more power than you do because we're funded by Al-Qaeda and we're funded by terrorist groups, and Saudi Arabia's given us a bunch of money, America's not behind you, we're going to help you fight Assad. You overlook that they hate women and Jews and Shia Muslims and Christians, and you don't agree with them on any of that. But sometimes the enemy of your enemy becomes your friend, even if it's your enemy. Now, and you've been fighting this guy before, but you might just seek their help. It's a terrible place to be in. Terrible place to be. When we come back, I want to get the perspectives from the other people in this conflict, from Russia, from Assad. What's he thinking? From ISIS, what are they thinking? Or al-Nusra? Or maybe, if there's time, America. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, trying to give a different perspectives on the Syrian conflict. Imagine you are the dictator of Syria. You are Bashar al-Assad. Your dad was in power since you were a small child. You are well-educated. The country is yours. It belongs to you. You're a member of the Alawi minority. You're not a Sunni Muslim like 90% of the country. You're a Shia Muslim. And you very much want to defend your people, and your people are in charge, and they're doing really well. And these people rise up against you as if somehow you were different from any other dictator in the Middle East. And you know what? This is your country. It was your dad's country. You're in control. You've got a great palace. You've got a beautiful wife. And who are these people that think they can control their own country? And you know that if you show the little bit of weakness, the way they did in Tunisia, that dictator's out. The way they did in Egypt, that dictator's out. And in Libya, he went around the United States and Russia. Not you. You're not stupid. You're smart. You're going to go with a superpower. You're going to go with Russia. You've already given them a base, their biggest naval base outside of their country. And you want those Russian planes. And you know that if you're going to continue killing all these people, you've got to have a strong person by your side. And it ain't going to be America. It's going to be Russia. You call forth Russia, and when times get tough and your army gets in trouble, you're going to bring Russia aboard. And you'll talk to America about killing the ISIS, but really you're going to use that power to kill the real danger, the Free Syrian Army. Because ISIS, nobody likes ISIS. The ISIS kills people in the West. If ISIS could never come to power in Syria, you know that. But the Free Syrian Army, that's a democratic group. So you're going to take all that time that you say is going to kill ISIS, you're going to go after the Free Syrian Army. If you're Russia, you got a naval base, you got a client, you got a way to expand Russian influence, all you got to do is murder a whole bunch of people. You're Vladimir Putin, that's no big deal to you. Kill a whole bunch of people, and this can be a Russian client state for years to come. And if you're Iran, you want to have power. You've got great allies in Assad, in Syria. You're already an enemy of the United States. You've got your own terrorist group in Hezbollah. They took over Lebanon, and now you can take over Syria too. It's all good for you. And if you're ISIS, well, you want an Islamic state. And you know this is the only way to impose an Islamic state, is to show that the only way out is through you. And also, the West isn't noticing. You want to get the West to notice? Kill a bunch of people in the West, and suddenly they'll take notice of your conflict. And maybe they'll just do something about it. Those are my perspectives on Syria. Hope I gave you a fuller understanding of the conflict. This is Mark Levine, signing off.